early education. We hear much about its value to our keiki, but it can be a hit to your budget. It's the first week of the first month of the year, but already the Open Doors program is taking applications. Needy families can tap this state-subsidized program to give their keiki a head start in learning. Joining us for the conversation today is Human Services Spokeswoman Kiopu Reels.
Preschool Open Doors is a program that the Department of Human Services has been administering for quite some time now. And what Preschool Open Doors really does is provide low and moderate income families the opportunity to invest in their children at that early age. So we're helping provide subsidies for low and moderate income families so that they can provide their keiki some early learning opportunities in preschools. And for this year in particular, we actually just passed a set of administrative rules or amendments to our administrative rules, which is increasing the subsidy that we're able to provide to families. And so that's really exciting for us that we can help. We had heard through one of the reports late last year, as well as from families and providers, that one of the key things is that people need more help out of pocket to help for early childhood education. And so we're glad that we're able to at least increase the subsidies to help, you know, really catch up with the need in our community.
Can you share with our listeners what is the cost of preschool these days and how much is your subsidy?
You know, I'm not sure. The preschools range. So we actually provide the subsidy for accredited preschools as well as for accredited license-exempt group child care centers. So they vary from center or preschool to preschool. But I can say that last year our subsidy maxed out at $710 for those accredited preschools and license-exempt group child care centers, and this year it's up above $900.
Wow, so it really is a huge help.
Yes. Yes, we're very excited for these new amendments to the administrative rules.
How many families do you serve every year?
So in the state fiscal year 2017, we served 1,767 children, so just over 1,700. Currently, we have around 1,400 children enrolled and for this current school year, and we're hoping to serve around 1,500 children in state fiscal year 2019, so that's starting in the summertime this year.
All right, so the open enrollment begins this month.
The open enrollment is already underway. Applications are due at the end of March, March 29th, and they will be good for the 2019-2020 school. It'll be good for the 2018-2019 school year. And what we ask is that parents remember that children, to be eligible for the Preschool Open Doors program, that children must be eligible to enter kindergarten in the 2019-2020 school year.
Okay, and then how do you qualify for this program?
So what we ask folks to do is you can either check online at our website, humanservices.hawaii.gov. We have some information there as well as the application, or you can check in with our contractor, Patch. And Patch can actually help you connect you with available resources as well for what kind of preschools are available. There are 431 state-licensed preschools statewide, so Patch is a great resource for that. And they'll also be the ones taking the application. So you'll fill out an application, provide it to Patch. There may be some documentation that they'll ask for, but you can work with Patch and just complete the application by March 29th, 2018.
All right. And you had mentioned that previously you had only had the open enrollment one time at the beginning of the year, but that's changed over time.
Yes, we found that we'd like to have all of our families be enrolled in this first, you know, to apply and be enrolled for the program in this first quarter. But we understand that, you know, there are a number of different community resources out there, which is great, right? So we have a lot of places where families can go to get help to give their children early childhood learning opportunities. And so what we found where there are families who may still be in need and we still have the capacity, we have opened additional open enrollment. We are very thankful for the commitment that the state legislature has given us in providing monies for this, and where we are still able to have those monies, so we have the appropriations left throughout the year, we will open application periods, but we just want to make sure that folks don't count on those open application periods, because our hope is that, you know, we'll be able to help as many children as we can, and fill up the program in this first enrollment period. But where we have the ability, the capacity, and we know that there's a need, we will open additional application periods.
Okay, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there are lots of programs that do help with early education. I believe at one time, I think Kamehameha Schools or another organization had a traveling preschool
here
on Oahu.
I'm not too sure about the details for the traveling preschool, and I would have to check on whether or not that's one of the accredited ones. But there are a number of opportunities, even for children before the preschool age, this age that we're looking for, kids going into kindergarten in the 2019-2020 school year. DHS actually licenses and registers child care centers and child care homes for folks to get care, because we know that in Hawaii, you know, a lot of our families are having to go back. They're two-income households where families either choose to or have to go back to work pretty early on in a child's life. And so DHS, we have a couple of roles. One role is in overseeing and making sure that we're trying to point people to the best healthy, safe opportunities for people to get childcare and also to provide childcare subsidies. So there are some other childcare subsidies that are available outside of the preschool open doors application period, and we have more information about that on our website as well.
Right, but if there are families out there who are weighing the rent versus preschool, this is really a great opportunity to get some help and get help for their family, for their child.
Absolutely. We have seen that when we invest in children, particularly in the sweet spot of ages 0 to 5, and we do continue to invest in different ways for our department for children older than 5 years old, but particularly when we see this investment in 0 to 5, we see that investment pays dividends, not just in their ability to be ready for school at that elementary level, but also, you know, decades down the line, we see higher earning potential, even from that early investment. And so the department is really committed to making sure that we provide as much support as we can. And we're very thankful for the work that our team does at DHS, but also for the commitment from the state legislature.
Is there any other place where you folks are doing outreach in order to get to those needy families?
So we rely very heavily on our community contractor, Patch. And so Patch does a lot of great work in connecting folks not only to these kinds of monetary resources or financial resources, but also to connecting people to open childcare spots or slots. So we work heavily with Patch, and if you have additional questions, Patch is a great resource to go and answer those kinds of questions, whether it's from getting financial help or to helping connect people to child care.
How much has the legislature set aside for this program?
So currently, my understanding is it's just over about $11.5 million for the Preschool Open Doors program.
So it's a big chunk.
It's a huge chunk, and we're very thankful for that kind of commitment. And we know that the state legislature understands this commitment and investment in 0 to 5 with that kind of appropriation, yes.
Is there anything else that you can share with us in the upcoming budget that the governor might submit as far as early education and programs like yours?
I know that we are asking asked for continued support of preschool open doors, and continued support of programs like these and subsidies. So when it comes to budget, we are continuing this ask for the commitment to early childhood education.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us on the conversation.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
Keopu Rields is the public information officer for the Hawaii Department of Human Services. Registration for the state's preschool open doors program is open until March 29th. Interested families can request an application at patchhawaii.org. You can also find a link to that application and guidelines for eligibility on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll be right back.
On January 13th, Leto Archangel brings his sweet falsetto and vibrant ukulele to the Atherton studio. Most of all, he brings his personal connection to each of the songs he sings, whether traditional or contemporary. Purchase tickets to Leto Archangel in the Atherton, January 13th at hprtickets.org. Preferred pricing for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, some of the striking findings of a Pew Research study of social issues. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're looking back to the early days of the Honolulu Fire Department. Fighting fires was pretty much a catch-as-catch-can effort in the first half of the 19th century, largely handled by volunteer bucket brigades. It wasn't until December 27, 1850, that the Honolulu Fire Department was established by order of Kamehameha III. It soon added more modern equipment, including hand-drawn water tanks and a hook-and-ladder company. The Central Fire Station on Union Street was for decades the tallest structure in Honolulu, and its bell tower was where a night watchman sat, ever ready to sound the alarm. Much of the mid-century modernization of the department took place under its second appointed chief, the man we're thinking of today. He was a longtime friend of the monarchy who served the kingdom in a variety of roles. He's probably best remembered as the so-called father of baseball, although that claim is often disputed by historians of the game. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that says, "You've got it right."
Aloha, I'm Eunice Sim from Hawaii Baptist Academy, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
American society was born in struggle and continues to struggle to reconcile the many sets of ideas, opinions, and perspectives that live within it. A new study from the Pew Research Foundation suggests that issues that divide us have grown more intense and more difficult to reconcile in the year gone by. Contributing editor Neil Milner has more in today's edition of The Long View. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Chris.
You know, you could sort of helicopter into any period of American society, of American history, and say, "Oh my Lord, look at all the divisiveness that's going on in this country." But it's always seemed to me that there was a gravitational pull toward resolving issues. Do you think that's breaking apart?
Well, you know, the difficulty with comparing historical periods is you don't know how long you should take the period.
Yeah.
What you can say about the period right now is that we've moved in a direction of polarization at a very strong, maybe unprecedented level over the past 20 years. And according to this Pew Research Center summary of its findings, It has gotten much greater. It's become much more important in a relatively short period of time, in some cases only a year. The Pew study it's based on surveys. They do surveys internationally and nationally. Mm-hmm. And then this cluster of the 17 is really about the increase in degree of polarization, even in the last year or so.
What are the most divisive issues? What defines that polarization?
Well, the first thing to understand is that political party, whether you identify as a Democrat or Republican, is now the most important difference in regard to the kind of 10 basic policy and race issues that they ask about. Mm-hmm. 15 or so years ago, maybe 20 years ago, whether you saw yourself as a Democrat or a Republican didn't make any more difference than the difference in religious attendance or the difference between whites and blacks or anything else. Now, Party identification is the marker. It's become, in fact, a social identity. So things like immigration, things like attitude toward whether whites have an advantage on race, whether the news media is a watchdog, whether colleges are beneficial to society. All of those things, the difference between Democrats and Republicans have increased over the past year, and some of them just over the last year since the Trump administration took over.
It says a lot about the tenor of the times that the issue of whether colleges are beneficial to society should even be an issue.
No, exactly. It's surprising, and that's increased, that a substantial portion of Republicans think that college has a negative impact on society. They're not saying don't go. That's not how the question was asked, but there's clearly that kind of difference.
Seeing them as sort of hotbeds of liberalism and mind control from
I guess
the left.
So. But, you know, that's not new either. That's been around for a long time, and that's divided along party lines. But the important thing is to see that this has really increased, that the degree of difference between Republicans and Democrats has increased. One of the most interesting ones along those lines is the attitude toward race, where race has become the question of whether a person is – whether – whites have certain advantages that blacks don't have. It used to be closer. Now a majority of whites think it's the case, and a majority of Democrats think it's the case, and a large group of Republicans think that it's not the case.
The Republicans have really identified with that particular area of thinking, the oppressed, what about me, the white man, kind of.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, in fact, that as more research goes on about the 2016 campaign, you're going to see, which you've already seen when we've looked at the data, that race, white resentment played a much more important role in the 2016 election than anything else. You have to remember that now the Republican Party is a white person's party. For sure. And the Democratic Party is really a party of color. Now, that's not 100%, but they divide in those lines, and there are significant differences in the degree of white resentment between people who identify as Democrats or Republicans. And you can see that it did manifest itself. There's a political scientist named Michael Tesler who's published some work on this, and you're going to see more in a subsequent book that he's coming out with.
I would, just from my perspective, Neil, I would trace the history of that particular area of Republican thinking to Ronald Reagan.
Well, you can maybe even go back beyond that or before that to Barry Goldwater, who made the stand against the civil rights thing. Mm-hmm. The Southern strategy of kind of pushing whites toward a more conservative racial posture, Nixon does that. Reagan had the very clear symbolic message when he gave one of his opening campaign speeches in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where where four civil rights workers had been murdered, maybe 20 years or so than that. So it clearly is, this is not an accident. The Republicans have clearly mobilized this, but it's deeper than that. There clearly is, race has historically played a role in this. In our society, racism has never really gone away. And whatever we would like to think about ourselves, there still is a great deal of resentment there. I'm not saying whether that resentment is justified. It certainly is justified in the eyes of the people who have it. But it's clearly there, and it clearly plays a role. And it shows up, at least in indirect ways, in the polarization stuff.
One of the other metrics that I thought was interesting that the Pew Research folks looked into was science, and the whole idea that science is something you get to either choose to believe in or not.
Well, that's an interesting thing that's happening. When I talk about these striking findings have a history, this is one of them. It's pretty clear over the last few years, and you see it in surveys and other things, that science has become, scientific questions have become political questions. Now, what that means is that people turn to their usual political sources to decide whether something is right or not. You see it on public health issues. You see it on climate change. What you see in this study is that among Democrats, people who are well-educated Democrats are more likely to see global warming as a problem than Democrats that have less education. Among Republicans, there's no difference. That is, that Republicans say with a college education are no more likely to see climate change as a problem than other kind of Republicans, which really does suggest another way of thinking about the politicalization of science, because the more educated you are, the more politically engaged you are, the more you're likely to turn to other sources that support your view to learn about things and what then that's happened in global warming.
In the case of science and in journalism, which is also under attack, we have established methods for finding out whether something is true or not. That seems to be eroding.
Well, it seems to be. We may still have established methods, and established methods can always be criticized. Belief in those methods. It's one of the striking findings in these striking findings is how differently Democrats and Republicans look at whether the news media is a watchdog and how precipitously that's changed in 1 year.
Yeah.
Just in one year, the gap between Republicans who think that the newspapers can be a watchdog, which is not many, has diverged dramatically from the number of Democrats who think that way, and that went up. So a lot of that has to do with the salience of the Trump administration. Democrats, of course, rely on the news. Republicans tend to think that the news is clearly biased in a liberal direction. Even some responsible, conservative, anti-Trump people have been on the media's case for being too hyperbolic.
Well, we'll have to see where that goes, Neil.
Yeah, I guess we do, Chris. And it's not looking like 2018 is going to be any different. This is a trend that's been around for a while. It's reinforced, and it's not that easy to change, certainly not in the short run.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science and the contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. You can learn more about that Pew Research study on the Conversation page on Facebook.
This week on Reveal, a drug rehab program that's all about hard work.
That's not recovery, that's a slave camp.
And free labor.
If 40 hours a week is a slave camp, then America's a slave camp, huh?
That was business as usual until our story hit the airwaves. How we made a difference in 2017 on the next Reveal.
This evening at 7, right after Bite Marks Cafe.
Hawaii has been a well-known wedding and honeymoon destination for decades, and the image of the newlywed bride and groom dressed to the nines, posing on a sunny beach, is a familiar one to all of us who live here. But that image is deceptive, as Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton tells us in today's reality check. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
All right. You've shattered a romantic image that I chose to carry in my mind, but what's the reality here?
Well, the reality is, as you said, we see a lot of people on the beaches with their wedding dresses and tuxedo or formal wear for men. But as it turns out, a lot of these people, maybe the majority or even the vast majority, aren't really getting married here. Some of them are honeymooners, and they're just getting some romantic pictures to celebrate their honeymoon. Others haven't gotten married yet and are going to get married later. So they're still getting pictures.
I'd been naive enough to think they were just either coming to or from the ceremony.
Right. Well, that's I think what a lot of people think. And again, this wasn't a major expose of blowing the lid off of the wedding industry here. But it is interesting that it's a big business for a lot of people. You know, these wedding pictures support a lot of people, photographers, hairstylists, makeup artists, photo assistants. And again, it's a bigger piece of what the tourism industry calls the romance market than a lot of people realized.
I never ever heard that term romance market before, but it certainly fits. You would think that Japan, for example, would offer plenty of picturesque backgrounds for a newlywed photograph, but somehow Hawaii has gotten really fixated in the mind in that culture, hasn't it?
It seems so. So what we found when we talked to a few people, and again, this wasn't a major survey of travelers as HTA does with the people coming in on the planes, but what we found was a lot of people are connecting with travel agents who are increasingly in Japan, who are increasingly offering this as a menu of activities to do in Hawaii. So people see this, they see it as a fun activity, and they sign up to do it when they get here.
Well, let's see. So you've got to hire a photographer. You've got to probably rent formal gear, yeah?
Right. Well, the companies package these. So, for instance, one is Kyla Weddings offers packages. So does a company called Cinevi TV. They offer everything, the dresses, the wear for the men, a photographer, an assistant, limo transportation, and really everything you'd need for the photo shoot, 100 pictures or whatever you sign up for. So it's all just one thing. Again, the men can hang out and at the spa and get a massage or something while the women get ready, and then they go off on their way to get pictures.
All about keeping that dream alive, huh, Stuart?
Yes, it is, Chris.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was business reporter Stuart Yurton with today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat.
For 118 years, Child and Family Service has been helping to strengthen our community, offering some 50 programs statewide. Today we introduce you to the new CEO at the helm, Karen Tan. But she's no stranger to the nonprofit, working within the organization for a number of years. Now she shares her vision of innovation, working within the challenges of a nonprofit.
First of all, we're creating an innovations room here at our Eva Beach office. And the reason why we're doing that is because we want our staff and leadership to be able to go into a place where they can problem solve, whether it be funding challenges or challenges working with issues in the community. We want to have that as an opportunity. The other things that, like another example, would be we're partnering with a national organization called the Alliance for Strong Families and Communities, and we're creating an opportunity for those older kupuna who have retired to come back and give back to our organization through volunteering. And that creates two really innovative ideas, which is one, connecting kupuna with children in a way that helps them both. Mostly the children really benefit from having someone in the kupuna help them and take care of them and really bond with them. And also, the second thing is that it helps the kupuna because they are often can be depressed or lonely after retirement. They don't realize it's going to happen, but it does. And so we give them an opportunity to come back and really have a second career, as we call it, and give them another focus each day so they're not just sitting alone wondering what to do.
So are these members of our kupuna group that have been involved in child and family service programs before, or is this just basically tapping a resource in the community?
It's tapping a new resource. Typically, they haven't been involved with us, and maybe they've been bankers or accountants or teachers, and so it really is about giving them an opportunity to come here and learn about who we are and then give back. So we've had great opportunities for them to talk to our alternative high school youth about career opportunities, helping them to see what their options are, and any other opportunities to volunteer here at our organization.
Right, and you're all about strengthening families, so really this is kind of a mentoring program, if you will.
Yeah, it really is, and you know what we want to do is give the youth and the children hope. That's one of the focuses we're wanting to do, and in order to give them hope, they need to see that there is life outside of where they're at the moment. And so if there's a, if they're one of our youth in our alternative high school that are struggling in school and maybe they've been suspended and now they're with us, having them meet with a person who's had a wonderful career, maybe has had their own challenges, and then hear from them and learn from them, it's a great win-win for both.
Well, that's terrific, because we certainly do have a growing community of seniors, and so that's really a wealth of knowledge you can tap into.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting is we are, I believe we're the oldest of old here in the nation as far as our kapuna, and so we really have that resource to tap into. And with, you know, funds getting tighter and tighter for nonprofits, you want to really look at that, as I call it, human resource opportunity of these wonderful kapuna who have so much to share.
And tell us about the programs that you have that help with this problem of homelessness in our community.
Well, you know, I think homelessness is, it's improving in our community. I heard recently, in fact, last week, that we've seen an 8% reduction in homelessness here in our community, which is really a good sign. Child and Family Service does not provide necessarily homeless shelters, per se, but we do work with families who are in poverty and trying to prevent homelessness. And so we work with, right now we have a program that we're piloting on Kauai and on Maui called Transition to Success, which is a model for how you work with families who are in poverty and really helping them to move out of poverty. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do to help the community.
Over the years, I've seen and talked to a large cross-section of homeless people at the camps across Oahu. Mm-hmm. And I'm just struck by the cycle, because you've got parents and children that have been out on the streets for 7 years or more. And it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there is a cycle of poverty, a cycle of homelessness. I think, you know, children learn what they're exposed to. So that's why we really like this Transition to Success model, because what it does is it helps us to work with the families, both the parents and the kids, to say, what are your hopes and dreams? And then we map it out for them. How do you get there? So, for example, if a youth says, I really want to be an NBA player, then we say, okay, what does it take to be an NBA player? We don't knock it down, because we understand that most kids aren't going to be an NBA player. Our first response is, what does it take to get there? Well, you've got to get to school, because most end up graduating from high school and go to college. But you haven't been going to school, so how do you get to school? Well, maybe, and then we break it down all the way to, maybe you need an alarm clock that works, because you're not getting up and going to school. But if you want to be an NBA player, you got to get your degree. So we really work with them to break down their goals and see that everything is achievable. And so that's the model that we're working out of, and that really helps. Because when you think about poverty, you think about, you know, the families, all they can worry about is really, where are they going to sleep and what are they going to eat? So to think beyond today is really difficult. So our model helps them to really begin to look at those hopes and dreams and map it out where they might not otherwise think that way.
Right, and you don't want to be known as a dream killer. I know I've done interviews with Marcus Mariota's teachers. I think one who I think had an assignment for Marcus Mariota for the class to, you know, talk about their goals, and he wanted to be, you know, a pro ball player. And she, I think, had basically said, well, you know, very few people achieve that goal. There are very few spots. But, you know, he was like, no, I really wanted to play pro ball. And he achieved it. So, I mean, what a terrific role model he is for the country, but then our kids here in Hawaii, to know
Absolutely.
That they can have that kind of success.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's what's really important, especially for kids who are in poverty, whether they're homeless or they're living in you know, like Section 8 housing or just really struggling. It's helping them to see that they can also have hopes and dreams. And one of the things that we always talk about here at Child and Family Services, hope is contagious. And so if, like, someone like Marcus has hope to do that one day, then, you know, other people kind of can get on the back of that and experience that hope too. And that's what we want to do for our community, is really grow the hope that there is a future for those, even those in poverty or living homeless.
Now, looking forward to 2018, one aspect, I think, of funding is a big problem for all nonprofits, but also accountability. And we've seen so many stories in the headlines today about an accountant or a trusted employee basically ripping off the nonprofit. We saw it with the ARC. We saw it with One Eye Comp last month. And it's just disheartening. And so I guess my question to you is as an organization, what safeguards do you have to make sure that people aren't just taking advantage of your organization? And when people give, the money is going to go to where they intend for it to go and not to line someone's pocket.
Right, right. Yeah, the stories that you shared are really difficult situations for those nonprofits. And I think most nonprofits, and I think even those that you mentioned, we have a lot of safeguards in place. We have our annual audits every year, and those are outside people coming in and taking a look at, you know, our systems and making sure that they are being followed and no one is taking advantage. We have checks and balances across the board when it comes to anything financial, just the processes that we take. Not to say that it can't happen. I think criminals in any industry can do what they're going to do, but I think especially for nonprofits, we have to really safeguard those funds that come in. And so, you know, I know for us, we have a lot of checks and balances to make sure that we're catching anything before it becomes a problem.
Right. Okay. New year, new direction, lots of hope ahead for Child and Family Service, and good luck to you going forward.
Thank you so much.
Karen Tan is the CEO of Child and Family Service, a local nonprofit dedicated to helping Hawaii's low-income and at-risk families.
Aloha, I'm Leilani Chan from Tiara Productions. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We live in a surveillance state, and there's no turning back. The revelations that have emerged in recent years about the National Security Agency's ability to tap into any phone, anytime, for any reason, has permanently shaped our consciousness in ways we're only beginning to understand. An upcoming series of films and workshops at the Honolulu Museum of Art called Classified looks at the ways we've surrendered our privacy and asks what we can do about it. Taylor Chang is the director of the museum's Doris Duke Theater. She's in our studio to tell us about the show. Hi, Taylor.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
What got you going on this idea?
Well, actually, for over a year now, I've been wanting to put together a program using surveillance as sort of a theme, mm-hmm. and figuring out ways to kind of further cultivate the intersection between art and tech at the museum. And it just so happens that, you know, the stars aligned for this particular program at this particular time. I'm just really glad that everything came together. The people who are participating, the resources, the timing was just perfect.
Well, you know, for most of us baby boomers who were influenced by the George Orwell novel 1984, and you include the film of that in this presentation, I just looked it up. That came out in 1949, that novel. And the whole idea of you were being watched was so shocking to us. And the whole, of course, 1984 entered the language and the culture as this notion of the surveillance state. But at first, when that came out, it was kind of an unthinkable fantasy.
Yeah, that film is a perfect film to really kind of kick off or, you know, to frame the program in a way. And it's fitting that it's a film that's commenting on these topics. You know, mm-hmm. film is a really fitting medium in which to engage with the topics of surveillance, and that it's a medium of looking and observation and lenses and how we perceive ourselves and others. So, you know, there's 1984. We have, you know, other films as well that are similar in theme and tone. But yeah, 1984 is really special. Of course, it coined the term Big Brother, and it's definitely influenced the way we perceive and understand surveillance today. But you know, beyond that, you know, the conversation that we have on Saturday, which engages various people, including Edward Snowden and mm-hmm. Trevor Peglin, and now Laura Poitras is joining the conversation.
The filmmaker
of Citizen Four and Risk. The conversation is aimed to kind of, you know, we have these films which serve as a platform to kind of, you know, remind ourselves of these topics and the way in which pop culture has engaged with them. But having these people come together for this talk, it allows us to elevate the conversation. You know, surveillance is portrayed in certain ways in these films, but, you know, how do we understand it in present day? Like, how do these films resonate now? And what is happening now that we should be aware of?
What's interesting about including film in this thing is, as you well know, film is often discussed as a kind of a passive for the audience, that the process of watching a
yes.
film is seen as this kind of a passive immersion and kind of voyeurism, too. You're getting into someone else's life, watching the movie without
right.
any consequence to yourself. You tend to watch films without the notion that camera can be turned toward you.
Totally. I mean, and it's amazing to think how much, you know, the premise of this entire program is to show how through art anyone can gain agency within complex societal structures, in particular, you know, complex systems of surveillance. But at the same time, sort of in reverse, it's amazing to think how much surveillance elements our experience of art or experience of our everyday lives.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on one level, yes, watching a film can be a passive experience. On another level, you know, walking through a museum, you know, as much as we're looking at art on a wall, we're being looked at by, you know, security guards, by surveillance cameras.
Yeah.
There's always a flip side to a camera. And there are so many creative ways in which to kind of look at and understand and experiment with that flip.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can turn a camera, anyone can turn a lens, anyone can turn a piece of technology, you know, for good or bad purposes. And it's just really interesting to explore that. It's surveillance becomes a really rich landscape to creatively explore.
In one of the things that you just touched on, Taylor, is a
yeah.
kind of a democratization of technology. It used to be that you could film or record someone if you had the equipment, usually if you were a professional, you know, it would take a certain high level of equipment. Now everyone with a phone can be a voyeur, can record
right.
reality as they want.
Right. And we take for granted that empowerment. You know, it's so ingrained into our everyday sort of experience. And yeah, it is a hyper democratization of the use of a camera or a use of a lens. But you know, beyond that, it's really sort of, you know, our engagement with technology as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, surveillance is kind of just an access point into that larger picture.
Well, when we consume art, when we go to a gallery, when we watch a film,
yeah,
we're acting as voyeurs.
Yes.
We're, you know, sneaking into somebody else's life.
Yeah.
And maybe getting a vicarious, you know, kind of shiver from it.
Yeah.
And yet when the notion, you know, that's come into society that somebody's watching you while you're watching them is resented. You know, wait a minute. I'm supposed to be able to watch you. You're not supposed to be able to
mm-hmm.
watch me.
But the power of voyeurism, interestingly, is that, you know, to be a voyeur, there's a creative process that goes into, you know, when you look at something or when you look at so many different things, in order to understand it or to comprehend it, you know, we all have to go through this narrative making process to understand something. You know, if we are presented with a film, you know, we engage with that film in a creative way by, you know, interpretation. But there's a narrative that goes into every single individual's interpretation of something that we look at. And that is on by itself a creative act, and super empowering, and everyone's able to do that. And you don't need technology to do that. You just need a brain. So it's like similarly, like, you know, with surveillance, you know, we can be presented with all of these images, all of this data. But in order to make sense of it, you have to be crafting a narrative. And that's really, I think, what makes me excited about this program, because we're really diving deep into the different ways we craft narratives when we're looking at things, when we're looking at ourselves and others. Surveillance is just an access point into that topic.
Well, whenever we perceive anything, whenever we take anything in, the whole notion of objectivity is ridiculous. It has to be filtered through our personality.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to get, you know, you might go seeking an objective view of something, but by the time it gets filtered through who you are, something of the objectivity has been lost.
Yeah. Actually, what's going through my mind now is kind of going back to a previous thing that you brought up, is the empowerment that each of us has to sort of interpretation.
Right.
You know, when, say, we're feeling like, you know, a larger power is interpreting us or classifying us in ways that are beyond our control. Anyone through art, for example, can tell their own story or craft their own narrative or take that narrative that is being placed upon them and flip it in a way that is, you know, it's a deeply artistic and political act.
Yeah.
And, you know, the artists who are participating in the program have each done that in their own ways. Hassan Alahi is well known for, he was surveilled post 9/11. And he surveilled himself and on his own sort of used his own surveillance of himself and flipped it to kind of show the ridiculous surveillance can be. And so he made an art project out of the ways in which he was surveilled by the FBI. Trevor Peglin is well known for documenting, you know, government locations that are assumed to be, you know, off the grid, but he will, you know, showcase the fact that they are, in fact, you know. And Kyle MacDonald and Lauren McCarthy, they both use surveillance technologies in really creative, innovative ways to kind of showcase or flip the narrative, so to speak, of you know, there's only one story that can be told about us at any given time, but in reality, there's an infinite number of stories, and we all have the power to flip those narratives.
We're going to get that power over in the next few days.
I hope so, yeah.
Taylor, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for letting me join you.
Sure. Taylor Chang is the director of the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art. The museum's series Classified explores surveillance in the modern world, runs from January 5th through the 11th. You can find a link to more details on today's edition of the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's backyard quiz, he was Honolulu's second fire chief back in the days when firefighting was a volunteer-driven bucket brigade affair. He was a friend, an ally to Hawaii's ruling monarchs in the second half of the 19th century, serving them in a number of key roles. As executor of Queen Emma's last will and testament upon her death in 1885, he was instrumental in the construction of the Queen's Hospital. He also appointed counsel to Peru and was on the financial committee for Honolulu's centennial celebration of American independence held on July 4th, 1876. He was a co-founder of the Honolulu Library and Reading Room in 1879, whose original constitutes excluded women and children. He objected, saying, "What makes us old geezers think we're the only ones to be spiritually and morally uplifted by a public library in this city?" The claim that he was father of baseball is widely disputed, but he was an early ambassador of the sport. What's not in doubt is the mark that Alexander Cartwright made on Hawaii history.
And Catherine, a number of people called in to give us the right answer, but the first were Kim and Doug, who called from the base of the Waianae Mountains, and they're today's winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. But a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on under the radar. Well, tomorrow, Derek, there's a church in Makiki that hosts its first farmer's market of the year.
That's right. Every Thursday afternoon, St. Clement's holds a farmer's market in the parking lot. Fresh produce and farm products are for sale, and you can purchase a dinner plate as well, and tables and chairs are provided for sit-down dining if you want to do that. The farmer's market is tomorrow, starting at 4:30 at St. Clement's on Wilder Avenue near the Makiki District Park.
And here's an opportunity to help get rid of invasives.
Yes, at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, Kipuka Pua'ulu has more native tree species per acre than any other forest in the park. So bring clippers or pruners and wear closed-toe shoes and yard-working clothes. Be prepared for any kind of weather. This is happening tomorrow. And meet in the parking lot at Kipuka on Mauna Loa Road off Highway 11 tomorrow at 9:30 a.m.
Given the location, you better be ready for any
That's
kind
right,
of weather,
right?
And volcanoes. You can learn how to play an ancient game of strategy on Maui tomorrow.
Yes, the Maui Go Club will meet at the Queen Kahaumanu Center food court to play this board game, which was invented in China over 2,500 years ago. It starts at 5:30, once again, in the Queen Kahaumanu Center food court.
Well, thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, with the start of the new year, Hawaii's minimum wage has gone up to $10.10. We'll hold a panel discussion and take your calls on the pros and cons of that minimum wage hike.
Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And you can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.